Welcome to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, where classical gourmands everywhere can finally get their fill. Join us for a delectable discussion of Greco-Roman civilization stretching from the Minoans and Mycenaeans through the Renaissance and right down to the present. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here are your hosts, Dr. David Noe and Dr. Jeff Winkle.
Welcome, everybody, to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, episode 10 today. Very exciting. My name is Jeff Winkle. I'm here in the vomitorium, as always, with my co-host and good friend, Dave Noe. How you doing, Dave?
I'm doing real well, Jeff.
Are you excited about today?
I am really excited. This is an interesting topic.
It's a fascinating topic.
You're going to take us down into the crypt beneath St. Peter's Church
Rome,
the
and
Vatican.
You're coming with me.
That's right.
Yes. Yeah. Fascinating story. Down into the necropolis, and we're talking about the alleged tomb of St. Peter.
Yes, the martyrdom of the apostle.
Yes.
And then his burial underneath the church.
Yes, exactly.
As the story goes.
Right.
So before we get into it, let's give a shout out to one of our loyal listeners.
We got one?
Yeah, we do. This friend is out in Midland, Texas.
All right.
A man named Aaron Richmond. We're going to have a Texas tie-in today in this episode, as it turns out.
Oh, that's right. Exactly. Yeah, so this is very appropriate.
Absolutely.
So thanks to Aaron for listening.
And yeah, thank you so much, Aaron. Tell your friends. This is going to be a really interesting episode for all of our listeners because those who are interested in classics, in some sense, all roads lead to Rome.
That's true.
As the saying goes. And that's where we're going to find the Apostle Peter, perhaps.
That's right. We'll see, we'll dig into the facts and the legends and see where we end up.
All right. Very good. And Jeff, you have an opening quote for us today to set us up, right?
I do. This is from one of the only kind of, as far as I know, kind of the full-length monograph treatments of this topic. This is a quote from a book called The Bones of St. Peter by a certain John E. Walsh.
John Walsh?
John Walsh.
Is this the America's Most Wanted John Walsh?
I don't
Walsh?
Believe it's the same guy, though, but I like imagining that it is.
Right.
I hear his voice when I read this.
Yes,
this
it's
quote.
A forensic exploration, isn't it? So
it
let's
is.
Have the quote.
The quote is, "Has the tomb of St. Peter really been found?" the Pope asked. To that question, the answer is beyond all doubt. Yes. The tomb of the Prince of Apostles has been found. Such is the final conclusion after all the labor and study of these years. A second question, subordinate to the first, refers to the relics of St. Peter. Have they been found? At the side of the tomb, remains of human bones have been discovered. However, it is impossible to prove with certainty that they belong to the body of the apostle. This still leaves intact the historical reality of the tomb itself.
Well, that's a fascinating quote, Jeff. Thanks for setting that up for us. So what do you think about Walsh here and what he says?
Well, I think these two key points are interesting, and we'll try to come to some kind of conclusions about these. I mean, he says, one, has the tomb been found? He says, without a doubt. The tomb is legit. It's an archaeological truth. But the tomb is different than the body itself. Have the bones of Peter been found? And I think at best, Walsh would say, possibly.
Qualified maybe.
A qualified maybe. That's right.
So we're relying on Walsh here in this episode. And,
yeah.
And also on your personal visit. See, I've never been to the Scavi beneath the Vatican. I've been to the church itself many times, but never down into the crypt.
Right. Next time you're going, though.
Okay.
Right?
So we're going to be the Ad Nauseam International Tour, right?
That's right.
The
exactly.
ANI.
Stay tuned.
So we're relying on your firsthand knowledge, but there's also another book. One that I went through in order to prepare for this episode, one that you had already read.
Yeah, The Fisherman's Tomb,
Fisherman's Tomb. Yeah, we'll put that up in the show notes in case you're interested.
Yeah, John O'Neill, I want
John
to say.
O'Neill.
It's another John.
Yep. It's a New York Times bestseller. Came out in 2018. It's an interesting book. I can say that much about it.
Yes.
That much about it.
Yes, the interesting is always a very interesting word.
Yes, it is. It's a well-chosen word here in this case.
It's not as academically grounded as the Walsh book. It's much more kind of for a popularizing audience.
Right? And the style is uneven.
Yes.
But we're not really here to critique that book, are we?
No, we're not.
Okay.
Lots of good information there to take away.
Lots of good stuff.
Yep.
So let's get right into it then. And we're going to talk about first, as I understand, who is the Apostle Peter? Maybe some of our listeners, maybe many, have some knowledge of who this man was. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of the New Testament evidence, which gets him into Rome or doesn't.
Right, exactly. Do you want to start us off there?
Yeah, I could do a little bit there. So the book of Acts, chapter 12, the Acts of the Apostles, there's this just slight notice, right, that after the persecution, it says, he, meaning Peter, departed and went into another place. Now, this place isn't specified. Where did Peter go at this time? The Acts of the Apostles follows Peter's journey up until about chapter 12, and then it takes over with Paul,
right,
which takes us right to the end, chapter 28. It's all Paul from that point on.
That's right. That's right.
So where did Peter go? Well, the tradition says, one tradition says, he went to Rome and served there for 20 to 25 years as a bishop. after he visited Antioch, a city on the Orontes, north of Jerusalem. So that's one tradition.
Right. So he's the leader of this burgeoning Christian community in Rome.
Correct.
Right.
Yep. And that's the Roman Catholic tradition as
yes.
well.
Yep.
And it's mentioned by Jerome. It's mentioned by Eusebius. So we have Eusebius, the beginning of the 4th century. We have Jerome, the end of the 4th century. So the tradition is not without some basis, for sure.
Right.
Is it demonstrable from the New Testament? Definitely not.
Right.
And there are a couple of clues that suggest it didn't happen. Or at least that he wasn't there early, I should say.
Right. What are those clues?
Well, the strongest one comes at the end of Paul's letter to the church in Rome, the book of Romans. That'd be chapter 16. Paul, you know, as is his custom, goes through a long list of the persons he wants to greet. You know, to the church in Rome, here are the individuals he's saying hello to. You finish a letter, you know, you greet the persons that are there.
Right.
Conspicuous by his absence is Peter.
Right.
So if Peter is in Rome, then... and Paul doesn't mention him, that's quite an interesting omission.
Yes, exactly. The church's tradition is quite strong that Peter was there.
Correct.
Right? But it's when you start getting to the chronology that it makes very difficult to say anything specific.
Exactly.
Now with Paul, the New Testament tells us very distinctly.
Definitely. We know from the end of the Acts that he was there.
That's right. He's appealing to Caesar.
Yep. Nero. Under house arrest.
Yes.
And has some freedom of movement to preach and engage in his other apostolic offices, even as he's under house arrest. And then in 2 Timothy chapter 4, the last letter that Paul wrote, he talks about his time in Rome and how he was saved from the jaws of the lion, which mm-hmm. some have taken as a reference to Nero, some as just more generally speaking persecution.
Right.
But no mention of Peter then
Once
either.
Once again, yeah.
And that's odd.
It is odd, right, right.
But did Peter end up in Rome later? Well, the tradition here is uniform, and there's no reason to disbelieve it, I
right.
would say.
Tough to talk about the specifics. I think we're on safe ground in saying, yes, Peter was there and mm-hmm. was very likely martyred there.
Yes, yeah. And a very important element in the New Testament that I should mention, we shouldn't overlook it. I don't think it's definitive, but strongly suggestive. And that is at the end of 1 Peter, the letter that bears his name, he says, "She who is in Babylon greets you."
Right, right.
And that has always been taken with quite a bit of plausibility to be a reference to Rome.
Exactly. Like in the Apocalypse, the Revelation.
That's right,
right?
The book of Revelation.
Babylon is Rome.
Yeah, it's the Old Testament representation of all that's, you know, carnal, corrupt, and troubling in the world to believers.
Exactly.
So when Peter says in his letter, "She who is in Babylon," he's most likely, almost certainly saying, "I'm here in Babylon." Reader should understand, I mean Rome.
Yes.
And so on.
Exactly. Right. We've established that they're there. And so I think we should talk about kind of what's the tradition about what happened to them.
So what was Rome like in the 60s, the second half of the 60s AD? What was going on when Peter and certainly Paul were there?
It's getting a little hairy.
Okay.
So Rome is under the reign of Nero, who is, I think he's one of those Romans, I think that even, you know, people who haven't studied this stuff have heard that name.
Absolutely.
And readily associated with kind of craziness,
mm-hmm.
right? Madness. And so Nero's going to he's going a little crazy.
Yep.
He started off his reign with great promise.
In 54, right? Succeeded Claudius.
Yes. So, he's a very young man.
Yeah. The first 5 years are generally peaceful.
Yes.
As the philosopher Seneca, his mother Agrippina, and Burrus, they're kind of governing and controlling Nero's most wicked impulses.
Right. He was a teenager at the
right.
time. Right. But by this time that we're talking about, he's offed his mom. He's terribly paranoid about conspiracy theories. He's having people killed. He seems much more interesting in playing his lyre and giving concerts.
Much more interested.
Much more interested, sorry, exactly. It seems most people didn't find that interesting at all. Like, you know, competing in the games, that's what was important to him, and governing simply was not.
And he had a major architectural project that he undertook in the middle of that decade.
Exactly.
The
right.
Domus Aurea, the Golden House.
Yeah. Right.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So it was this massive house. I mean, today in Rome, almost nothing of it survives. There's one underground chamber that you can sometimes visit. But it was this, I think I read from end to end, it was a mile and a half long.
Yeah, enormous. The largest structure ever built was Nero's ambition at the time.
Yes, exactly right. And it connected the Palatine Hill down through the valley where the Colosseum is today, over to the next hill over. It was massive, and it was a clear testament to the man's own ego.
Yeah, the megalomania.
Right.
But in order to build it, according to the tradition, specifically Tacitus. What did Nero have to do?
Well, burn the city down.
Right.
And so there's this massive fire, 64, I believe, is the summer of 64, which is also a Bryan Adams song.
Yeah, I think a cow kicked over a milk pail
something
or a lantern,
like that.
Something like that.
Like that. And
I might have my city wrong.
But the city goes up in flames. And a huge chunk of it burns down. From this comes the famous story that Nero fiddled while Rome burned.
Right.
Right. And so this tradition developed that while the city was burning down, it seems to have started somewhere in the area of the Circus Maximus. Most historians think that Nero likely had nothing to do with it.
Right.
But the story takes over is that he burned the city down on purpose.
Yep.
And one of the reasons was that he wanted inspiration for his next poem. He wanted to write a song about the fall of Troy.
Yeah.
He wasn't getting inspiration just walking around the palace. So he says, well, I'll burn the city down. I'll watch it from my parapet, and I'll be inspired.
And then I'll be able actually to build my Domus Aurea.
Exactly right. So that was the other part of the rumor is that he starts clearing the rubble, and he starts building this massive house to himself. And so the populace said, it seems a little fishy.
Right.
Yeah, maybe he lit the match.
In fact, the poet Lucan, right, who was a friend of Nero, there's a lost work by his De Incendia Urbis on the burning of the city.
Oh, yeah.
And some suggest that this is where Lucan finally fell out of favor with Nero because he pointed the finger a little bit in that poem.
Right. Yeah. So interesting. Now, our best evidence suggests that Nero probably wasn't even in town.
Right.
He was somewhere further south when this happened. It's not to say he couldn't have had his goons do it.
No, but perhaps the most likely explanation is that he profited from the disaster.
Yes.
In terms of having real estate available for his monumental architectural project.
It was a bad move.
Right.
Terrible PR. Right?
And what does Tacitus say then about how Nero sought to cover this up and win back the Roman population?
So Nero gets very nervous. He feels kind of the tide of public sentiment rising up against him. So he needs a scapegoat. And so he points the finger at this small group of Christians that were in Rome at the time, that were apparently kind of already on the outs, you know, from a Roman point of view, a bunch of weirdos.
Right. Often associated with the Jewish population in Rome.
Yes.
And Rome had a very strained relationship with its Jewish population.
Exactly.
Exiled under Claudius, then brought back.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Ideas, like monotheistic ideas, didn't square with kind of a Roman worldview.
Definitely not.
Right. And so weirdos at best, you know, treasonous at worst.
Right.
Nero thought, okay, this is an easy scapegoat. People already hate these people. I'll blame the fire for them and take the heat off me.
And Tacitus tells us about this.
He does, right. Yeah. So Tacitus, a Roman historian.
Of about 20 to 25 years later.
Yeah, which in terms of kind of our historical sources is pretty close.
Oh, yes, it's on the nose, really.
It's on the nose, yeah, exactly. Right, so mentions this, and Tacitus also famously mentions that it backfires.
Right.
That Nero takes his immense cruelty out on these Christians, rounding them up, throwing them to the wild beasts, crucifying them. Public pity actually kicked in, and the Romans, according to Tacitus, say they saw kind of Nero for the madman that he was.
And this is the origin of the legend that Christians were martyred in the Colosseum.
Right, which is impossible.
It's impossible because it was built much after this time period.
Right.
Now, it's not impossible that Christians were martyred in the Colosseum.
There's just not much evidence for it.
Right. Well, and it certainly didn't happen during the reign of Nero.
Right. Exactly right. So that's
the structure wasn't built.
Exactly right. But yeah, that's one of those ways in which legend and history kind of collapse into another kind of story. Right. So getting back to Peter, the story goes is that Peter, as the leader of this flock of Christians in Rome, gets rounded up into this, and he is ultimately martyred, crucified by tradition, upside down, by his own request, as part of this wave of persecution, this first great persecution of Rome.
Right.
Yeah.
And in New Testament terms, the end of the Gospel of John, John chapter 21, has often been taken, with plausibility, to be not merely a prophecy of Peter's death, but Christ prophesying that Peter would suffer a violent death.
Oh, right.
You know,
right.
Someone will dress you and take you a place you don't want to go.
Yes.
So this is taken as a prophecy, as I said, that Peter suffered a violent death.
Yes, exactly. So in terms of kind of the geography and the archaeology of this, I think Tacitus tells us that Nero used his circus, which is sometimes called the Circus of Nero or the Circus of Gaius Caligula, an earlier emperor, which is across the Tiber River in an area known as the Vaticanus. And it was the location of lots of these martyrdoms and executions. and the Vaticanus. You can see where this is going.
Right.
The Vatican.
This is the Mons Vaticanus.
The Mons Vaticanus.
The Vatican Hill, the Vatican Mountain.
This is where kind of the church tradition takes over, is that Peter was crucified there, and his body was taken down off the cross and then buried in a kind of pauper's grave mm-hmm. in a cemetery, basically across the street.
Yes, and another interesting legend that goes right before that is that Peter was initially going to try to flee that persecution.
Yes.
And he was on his way out of Rome. This is the story. He's going down the Via Appia, and an apparition of the risen Christ appeared to him and said...
Is it Peter that asks? He says, quo vadis, Domine? Where are you going,
right.
my Lord?
Where right? are you going, Lord?
And Jesus says something like, I'm going to Rome to be crucified all over again?
That's right.
Yes.
And Peter then, in a fit of remorse, which is, you know, in keeping with how he is displayed in the Gospels generally, an impulsive, important figure who then regrets things sometimes,
yes.
turns around, walks back into Rome, and is then crucified upside down.
Right. So it's almost kind of like a do-over for his denial.
Correct.
Right.
It's a chance to redeem himself in a sense. And there's a little chapel there along the Via Appia. We've both been there.
Yeah.
And you can look at the alleged spot where Christ walked on the Via Appia, and there are footprint-like impressions in the marble.
That's right. Exactly. Fascinating spot, right? There's all, and that's just one of hundreds of those kinds of places in and
definitely,
around Rome.
Definitely, yeah. Not far from the Tomb of the Scipios, if memory serves.
No. Yeah, it's right down there on that kind of famously well-preserved section
right.
of the Via Appia.
So in any event, Peter's almost certainly in Rome, dies in the persecution. What happens next?
Well, the church tradition kind of takes over here. And I think it's good to be skeptical about these things. I think you should start with skepticism and move from there, because the Roman histories are largely silent on these kinds of things.
Correct.
But there does seem to develop a fairly early tradition, and we're talking into the second century.
Middle of the second century.
Yeah, within 100 years.
Yeah, so maybe around 140, 150.
Right. There is evidence that the site of Peter's tomb and Paul, too, who was also martyred south of the city, the way out to Ostia, that those tombs had become sites of pilgrimage.
Mm-hmm. And here I should mention the work of the 19th century historian Philip Schaff, not exactly current, but a Swiss-American historian, and he mentions Clement of Rome, end of the first century, says that Peter was martyred there, doesn't say anything about the location. Later in the middle of the next century, you have men like Ignatius of Antioch who mentions it, Dionysius of Corinth. I'm just quoting here from Volume 1 of Schaff, Irenaeus of Lyon, Caius of Rome.
Yeah.
They all mention that Peter was martyred and in Rome.
Yeah. And I think from a historian's perspective, that's decent evidence.
It's pretty good.
It's pretty good. Yeah. It's within a chronological frame that's persuasive.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Caius of Rome... One of the quotes that is often pointed to as evidence for this, he was an early Christian theologian. We don't know much about him. His work survives in fragments, but there's a fragment in which he's responding to a skeptic about these kinds of things.
And, so it's a polemical context, right?
Yes, exactly right.
The skeptic says, your Christianity is all baloney.
Exactly right. And so he comes back, and in this famous fragment, he says, listen, I can show you the tropea, the little monuments,
right.
the trophies of the apostles. Because if you want to go to the Vatican or on the road to Ostia, you'll find the tropea of those who founded this church.
Yes.
So it's a reference to Peter and Paul.
And to Paul, respectively.
Yes.
Yep. So then Philip Schaff says, in reference to these early mentions of Peter's martyrdom, he says, these testimonies from various men and countries differ in particular circumstances. They can only be accounted for on the supposition of some fact at the bottom.
Yes.
In other words, Peter was martyred in Rome.
He was. Right. Now, we should say that, I mean, that's a whole other question than saying that this tomb we're about to talk about is the real deal, but the tradition seems to be very supportive and persuasive that he's there,
yep.
and he dies there.
So the early Christians then, according to the legend, they gathered up Peter's remains.
Yes.
And they buried him in that spot.
In that spot, very close to the circus.
Yep.
Where he was killed.
Where right. today stands a massive granite obelisk.
Yes, exactly.
In the Piazza di San Pietro, in
right,
front of the Vatican.
Which is the last kind of silent witness to this, that obelisk stood in that circus.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing of that circus, nothing else survives.
And where did this granite obelisk come from?
From Egypt.
It's from Egypt.
Right. There's a number of obelisks in Rome.
Right, brought to Rome by Augustus, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
and then set up in that circus,
exactly.
at the base of which Peter was crucified.
Yes.
The story goes.
Exactly right. The Romans loved kind of the exoticness of Egypt.
Absolutely.
A lot of people still do.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So where do we go from here? So let's talk about kind of the next couple hundred years then.
Okay.
Christianity remains, for the most part, kind of on the outs from a Roman point of view.
We have that famous correspondence between Pliny and Trajan.
Right.
About what should we do? How should we persecute them? Should we persecute them?
Right. And Trajan seems to be the most kind of benevolent of these, saying that, you know, don't go kicking down doors.
Right.
They're still kind of hinky.
Yep. If they get out of line, punish them. But otherwise, leave them alone.
Leave them alone, right. But there were other emperors that had no problem kicking down doors, like Valerian, and then later Diocletian, whose persecution of the Christians is sometimes called the Great Persecution.
And the last, maybe.
The last and Great Persecution.
Yeah, so Valerian is in the middle of the 3rd century.
Yes.
Diocletian, right at the beginning of the 4th,
which is
the early 300s.
Right before Constantine,
right before
everything changes. It's tough to be a Christian. And so we have to imagine that people going to these shrines of Peter and Paul had to probably likely have done it in secret. Keep it very much on the down low.
At night, often?
Yes, exactly. But then everything changes with Constantine.
So what happened to the remains then between 65, 66, when Peter was most likely martyred, and up to the time of Constantine? Where were they?
We don't really know. There's a lot of unanswered questions here. And so they were, you know, buried in this small little grave. We'll get into this a little bit later, but some suggest that they had to be moved at some point.
One story said they went into the catacombs.
Into the catacombs.
Yeah,
yes.
San Sebastian, and then were brought back when the coast was clear.
That's right. So they had to be moved around because during these persecutions, sometimes these shrines were targeted.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's talk about Constantine. Can you walk us through this history?
Sure. So the 4 tetrarchs under Diocletian, one of them was Constantius Chlorus, Constantine the Yellow.
The Yellow.
Or Constantius the Yellow. That's what Chlorus means. He was the father of Constantine the Great, and Constantine the Great's mother was Helena.
Yes.
Helena Augusta.
That's right.
And in 306, Constantius Chlorus died campaigning against the Picts, if I'm not mistaken, and his soldiers hailed his son, Constantine the Great, as emperor in York, England.
York, England?
Of all places.
What were they doing out there?
Well, this gives a good indication of how far flung the Roman Empire was at this point.
Yeah.
It was a very massive empire. Constantine didn't visit Rome for some time after this.
That's right.
You can be declared emperor in York.
The Tetrarchy was kind of designed to, in some ways, manage this unmanageable beast.
That's right.
It starts to collapse right away.
That's right. 2 in the west, a Caesar and an Augustus, 2 in the east. And one of these fellows was Galerius. So for a short amount of time, Constantine and Galerius ruled together. And Galerius issued the Edict of Toleration in 311.
And what did that do?
Well, it means that Christianity is no longer a forbidden religion. So it's the end of the persecutions.
Yes.
It's now a religio licita, that is a permitted religion. And then in 313, Constantine himself will issue the Edict of Milan, which gives Christians favored treatment.
And why would Constantine favor the Christians?
Well, it's because apparently he had a conversion of his own.
Oh.
And this is the story given about his battle, his conflict with Maxentius at the Milvian Bridge, just outside of Rome, in 312. So Eusebius, his early biographer, and then the later sources say this as well, that Constantine had a vision. And in this vision, he saw a cross in the sky, and he heard the words or saw the words, in hoc signa vinces, which means...
In this sign, you will conquer.
That's right. Waking from his vision, Constantine had his soldiers place the sign of the cross on their helmets and on their shields. They rode into battle, devastated and defeated Maxentius.
It was a rout.
That's right. And from that point on, now Constantine, the absolute ruler, promotes the interests of Christianity. Now, in the Eastern Church, Constantine is a saint.
Yes.
He has been canonized by the Orthodox Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church. Not in the West, though.
No.
Constantine is not a saint in the Roman Church.
Well, there's lots of historical kind of mystery about to what degree, you know, was Constantine a Christian himself, right?
So we have to do that in another episode.
Yes,
but
right.
We can say...
Too much for this. Yep.
We can say for sure that he was baptized on his deathbed.
That's right. Exactly. Right,
and we know that for sure.
But... Let's get this back to the, kind of the topic of the day.
So what did he do then in terms of archaeology and Christian construction, specifically in tandem with his mother, Helena Augusta?
He seems to have had a deep interest in, I guess, what we would call relics. What I point to is kind of where that that really deep interest and kind of fever for relics and holy relics really begins in the history of the Christian church. And so he sends his mother, Helena, to the Holy Land, where she finds places and things associated with the life of Christ.
Yes, finds his birthplace in Bethlehem.
Yes, the sepulcher.
His burial place at Golgotha.
Pieces of the cross,
yeah,
things like that.
The nails of the cross, pieces of wood.
Exactly, right.
Brings them back, and Constantine melts them down, some of these nails and so forth, puts them in the point of his spear and on his helmet.
That's right, that's right. And in Rome itself, he consecrates the alleged grave of Peter by building the first St. Peter's Cathedral Basilica above that tomb.
And this was 337.
337. Takes a number of years to build, but arranges the church such that the kind of the high altar is right above the grave of Peter.
And this construction was all wood, if I'm not mistaken.
It was all wood, right.
Although it stood for almost 1,000 years.
Yes, yes.
A very long time.
Yeah, over 1,000 years, right.
Escaped many devastations and fires and so forth.
Incredible. But there's this kind of idea, I think, that you find in Catholic Church around the world, that some kind of relic sanctifies the space,
mm-hmm.
right? And in terms of the kind of the history of the church, you know, the Catholic tradition of Peter being the first pope, there's in some ways no more holy relic than the bones of that particular saint.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Jeff, the big announcement.
This is the week.
We have a sponsor.
Who's the sponsor?
It's Hackett Publishing of Indianapolis, Indiana, Cambridge, Massachusetts. You know Hackett, don't you?
I do. I love Hackett. I know that you and I have both used their translations in our classes. I love their attractive books on the outside. Great translations on the inside. My students love them.
You've used the Iliad.
Odyssey, the Bacchae.
Okay.
What about you?
I've used their translations of Plato and Descartes in my philosophy courses.
Greco-Roman history and beyond.
They run the gamut.
They run the gamut.
So, ad nauseum listeners, if you go to Hackett Publishing, H-A-C-K-E-T-T, HackettPublishing.com.
Yes.
Hackett is offering you a 20% discount off any title.
Any title.
Paperback or hardcover.
And free shipping.
And free shipping. 20% plus free shipping. Now, you have to use the special code. It's A-N, as in ad nauseum, 2020, the current year.
AN2020. They plug that in the coupon code box.
And that's
that,
right.
That will get them this deal.
So drop your favorite title, put it in your shopping cart at checkout, enter the code AN2020, and then enjoy.
You won't regret it.
That's right. So thanks to Hackett for their generous sponsorship. We're very
Indeed.
Grateful.
Yeah.
All right, Jeff. So let's fast forward to the Renaissance. Church built in 337. Bring us up to the 16th century. What's happening at the beginning?
16th century. So this is the kind of the high Italian Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
By this time, the Constantine's church is starting to totter and fall down. This is under Pope Julius II, who is widely remembered as kind of the great patron of artists like Michelangelo.
Extraordinary ambition.
Extraordinary. And decides that it's no longer worth kind of patching up and supporting the old church. It's time for another kind of testament to his own legacy, right?
So they demolish the entire structure.
They do.
In the process, destroying lots and lots of really valuable archaeological evidence.
Exactly right. Lots of things that, archaeologists would kill to be able to kind of see and explore. But bulldozes it, puts up the church that you see there today.
Begun in 1506, I believe.
Yes, and took 160 years to
build. Yeah, not really finished until 1666.
Yes.
Right at the end of the 17th century.
So Julius himself did not live to see it finished. Michelangelo did not live to see it finished.
Although Julius was blessed with an enormous amount of artistic talent. Bramante, Michelangelo, those are just the two most important names. Later on, Bernini in the 17th century, long after the
square,
death.
Which is more of an oval, right?
That's right.
So it's a massive building. You know, well, you and I have been there a number of times, mm-hmm. and it never fails to kind of just kind of bowl me over.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. Standing there by the obelisk, the massive facade. I mean, you could have fit Constantine's basilica neatly inside this thing,
right?
It's a massive building.
As tall as it is wide.
It is. It makes it, you know, in terms of kind of the story we're telling today, it makes it very difficult to kind of, in your imagination, to kind of to see it as it was,
mm-hmm.
Because every corner and square is filled.
Right. With Baroque ornamentation.
Yes.
Thanks to Bernini. Statues that line the top, massive, colossal statues of Peter and Paul out in front of the facade.
That's right.
And then the dome itself, designed by Michelangelo.
By Michelangelo, right.
And the inspiration for the U.S. Capitol and numerous other domes around the world.
Yes. It's an overwhelming experience to stand in front of it and to walk through it.
Yeah,
it's designed to kind of to punch you in the face.
Overwhelm you. Yeah,
yes.
The Pietà, his Pietà inside.
Yes.
Behind glass now, bulletproof glass.
Right.
So it's an incredibly overwhelming aesthetic experience
right.
to see this basilica.
Exactly.
Down below, when Constantine built the wooden basilica on top of the remains of Peter, as he understood, there were already Roman tombs there.
Yes.
So what happened with that?
Well, it was an incredible kind of feat of engineering, right? He had to basically move multiple tons of dirt and basically bury this cemetery.
Yes. Now, the Romans, the Greeks, they had a name for this city of tombs, right?
Yes.
It's the title of this episode. It's called?
A necropolis.
A necropolis, yes. Right. City of the dead.
Of the dead, right.
So all of these tombs, and Constantine and his engineers filled all of this in with millions of tons
yes.
of dirt, and packed it down.
And that became the foundation for the church above.
And they built it right on top of that.
Right.
So all of that is intact, even as Julius and his engineers scrap the basilica on top.
Yes, that remains the same. The altar that you see there today, designed by Bernini, is up above where Constantine's altar was, which is up above the alleged tomb.
So now, Jeff, we need to move forward 300 years.
We do.
From the end of Bernini up into the 20th century.
That's right.
And what's going on with the basilica at this point?
Well, it's the year is 1939, which I find kind of doubly incredible. Because 1939,
it's an important year in world history, isn't it?
Exactly. So Hitler's invaded Poland.
Yep.
And of course, as I'm sure our listeners know, Italy and Mussolini and the fascists are all wrapped up in that as well. So I find it doubly fascinating that the story we're about to tell is happening at this time in
right.
history. But 1939, Pope Pius XI dies. And the story goes is they're digging down in the grottos.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to St. Peter's today, there's kind of a basement
right.
that you can go down where many popes and other dignitaries have been buried. And
is open to the general public.
Yes, exactly right.
For an admission ticket.
Right. But, so it's an incredible thought to be, you know, an incredible honor to be buried there.
I guess I should say, for the interest of accuracy, you can enter the basilica without paying a fee.
That's right.
The museums are fee-based.
That's exactly right, yeah.
But you can get into this grotto and you can see the tombs of the popes.
Yes, it's incredible.
So they're digging around down there for a place to bury Pius XI.
That's right. And in doing so, kind of they break through the floor and they find the tops of these Roman tombs
mm-hmm.
from this first century cemetery, this first century necropolis.
First and early second.
Yes.
Right.
As far as we know, the tradition that Peter is buried beneath the altar has been long accepted by Catholics, but there wasn't any kind of what we would call kind of archaeological interest or explorations. I think some of that kind of went on in the 16th century when they're building the new basilica, didn't find anything. Most archaeologists think they were digging in the wrong spot.
Right.
Not really interested in it, or just it was very inconvenient. The whole church stands on top of it. What are you going to do?
Right.
So these workmen report to Pope Pius XII, who is the pope during World War II,
mm-hmm.
and tell him what they found. And Pius XII is very interested. And so he decides, keep looking around.
Now, Pius XII has come under a lot of criticism.
Very controversial
because
pope.
Of his relation to the Nazis.
Exactly right.
And the O'Neill book, which contains a lot of interesting information about Pius XII, seems to me to be trying to exonerate him somewhat.
Yes.
In terms of his reputation. And maybe the exoneration is legitimate.
Yes, exactly right.
But I don't know.
That's a whole part of a bigger story that we can't
Correct.
Really tell here.
Yep.
Right.
So they find this Roman necropolis.
Yes. And so Pius says, okay, we're going to explore this, but we're going to keep it in-house.
Yep.
Right?
It's entirely secret.
Entirely secret.
But we need to finance it.
Right.
Exactly. So how are we going to do that?
So how do they do that?
Here's the Texas tie-in. They find a devout Catholic billionaire, a man named George Strake. Born in 1894, dies in 1969, and he's a Texas wildcatter, which means someone who goes out prospecting for oil. And due to his perseverance, man of humble origins, as O'Neill says, he discovered one of the largest oil fields in all of the United States, maybe the largest.
That's right. It's like the Beverly Hillbillies.
That's right. It's the Conroe
Texas
oil
tea.
Field. Yeah,
right.
750 million barrels of oil have
My
been
gosh.
Taken out of that spot. So now he has so much money that a private emissary of Pius XII approaches Strake and says, I want to dig underneath the Vatican, or maybe doesn't tell him all the details. It's not clear. O'Neill's recounting is all cloak and dagger.
Right.
But will you finance it?
Yes.
So Strake says yes.
And Strake does seem to have been like a friend of Pope's, right?
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
As well as Hollywood movie stars and the whole thing.
Yes. But. So he writes the check. And so this work goes forward.
Now, who were the experts that Pius XII employed in this excavation?
Right. Well, here's where part of the many problems begin, right? So he hires a friend of his, a guy by the name of Lucas Haas, to oversee the project. Now, one of the problems is Haas is not an archaeologist. He's an academic, but he's not really, probably you would say, not the best trained to direct this kind
not
of thing.
Not a specialist.
Right.
So you and I know some things about archaeology, but nobody's going to ask us to excavate underneath the Vatican.
Exactly, nor should they. Right. But he also hires a legitimate archaeologist, although, as I think as O'Neill tells us, he was pretty much fresh out of school.
Right.
A guy by the name of Antonio Ferrua, I think you say his name. And immediately there's tension between Haas and Ferrua. So Ferrua, the way O'Neill paints him, he kind of wants to do it his way. This is his project. He resents Haas being there.
Mm-hmm. A bull in a china shop.
Yes.
Comes off very bad.
Very badly. So he starts digging down there. Haas gets irritated with kind of his procedures.
His disregard for priceless relics. I mean, priceless in the sense of they could have contained a lot of ancient information.
Right. O'Neill, and I think, as I remember, Walsh kind of suggests this too, that Ferrua was kind of, he was interested in finding Peter.
Yeah.
But along the way, you know, he's going through this necropolis, and there's all of this, these
frescoes,
inscriptions, which apparently also Ferrua had he just kind of declared it gibberish,
right.
Not important. And he's kind of just kind of bulldozing through these things, destroying things almost in a kind of a Schliemann-like manner.
Yep.
And Haas he's on the outs. Walsh tells kind of a more detailed story where it ended up that Ferrua would go down and do some digging. Then Haas would come down on his own.
He'd sneak in later and take things out.
He'd take things out.
To try to save them.
Undoing the work of the other person and not telling the other person what they're doing. It's a mess.
Right.
It's a mess.
No photography. None of the typical standards of archaeology were observed in the early stages.
Right.
And this is not the era of Schliemann, you know, whom you just badmouthed, but you can kind of forgive Schliemann a little bit. That was 1870,
exactly.
1880. This
exactly
is 1940.
Right.
The science of archaeology has advanced considerably. But Ferrua, they're still doing some things they really shouldn't.
Exactly right. And O'Neill talks about them going down there with like oil lamps. There was a flood at one point that kind of filled up the chamber. And of course, you have to imagine you're digging out the foundation of this massive...
One of the heaviest structures in the world.
ever built.
And so they're adding concrete pillars underneath to hold the thing up while they're excavating.
Right.
So not easy.
Not easy, right. But the infighting, it muddies the waters and it raises lots of questions that are still very difficult to answer to this day.
But they did find what they initially thought were... the bones of Peter.
They did.
So they take him out and they stay in the Pope's apartment in a box.
Right.
For a decade.
A long time.
Yep.
Right. Now we'll put some images and some maps in the show notes so people can see this. But they do ultimately come upon this little courtyard. You know, it seems to be more or less directly beneath the modern altar, several feet up.
Hmm.
And they find this little, as Caius of Rome describes, this little tropea.
Right.
This little kind of, it's a small little columned, probably if you stood next to it, it might come up to your waist.
Right.
This little kind of balcony or little awning. That seems to be over the slab of a grave.
Now, tell us about the graffiti wall, because this is really crucial.
Yes.
This looks toward the end of the podcast here, but tell us about the graffiti wall. It's such a central element in the story.
Right. Take a look in the show notes so you can visualize this better.
Jeff, you don't want to sink the internet, do you?
Sink the internet?
Well, I mean, if you ask people to go check out the show notes, there's some things happening this week in terms of American politics, but we put this in the show notes. The internet's going to go down when people go there to find out about this
stuff. It's true. It's a risk I'm willing to take.
Okay.
Yeah. So there is this odd, as David just mentioned, this, what's called the graffiti wall that kind of sticks out from the back, what's called the red wall, from which this tropea protrudes. It doesn't seem to be built to kind of support anything. It doesn't have any kind of architectural purpose. But it's this wall that sticks out, kind of flanks the tomb itself. And as the name suggests, it's covered with graffiti. Yeah.
And originally, Ferrua said, this is gibberish, it's nonsense.
Exactly. Don't pay any attention to it.
Just ignore it. But now, enter the story, if it's not too early.
Yeah.
This very important Italian archaeologist, a woman, Margherita Garducci.
Yes. Hang on to that for just one second.
Okay.
All right. Like you were saying, they find some bones in what seems to be the grave of Peter underneath that slab. They're taken away in the Pope's apartment where they sit for a long time. Now, the graffiti wall comes into play. Because at some point in the comings and goings, somebody punches a hole at the bottom of the graffiti wall and reveals it to be hollow. And one of the things that had really irritated this Lucas Haas is that he didn't like how Ferrua was treating the human remains that he was finding. He was just kind of bulldozing, throwing out human bones on his way to Peter's grave. And so Haas discovered that inside the graffiti wall was another set of bones wrapped in a purple cloth. And he said, the last thing I'm going to do is tell Ferrua about it. And so Haas takes those out, puts them in a box, puts them in a storeroom where nobody else knows about them, and then proceeds to die without telling anybody what he's found.
Oh, that's really fascinating, Jeff. As I look at my show notes here, I think we both have been using the wrong name, actually, for this archaeologist.
Oh, what's the name?
Well, we've been saying Lucas Haas, but it's actually Ludwig Kaas.
Ludwig Kaas.
Ludwig Kaas.
Oh, apologies. Yeah.
Well, our German isn't so great.
So. It isn't. So we'll Kaas from here on out.
That's right. So what happens next?
Long story short, after a number of years, the bones that were found in what seemed to be the legitimate grave that Furua found are finally tested and looked at, and determined to be not the bones of a single man, but of many different people.
Including one woman?
Yes, a woman.
And a mouse.
And a mouse, right.
The story goes that a mouse crawled inside the box, poor thing, and died there.
Yes.
So the collection of bones is not from one man, therefore can't be Peter.
Furuo, apparently, according to O'Neill, was livid over this, right? He had thought for many years that he had found the bones of Peter, and but the investigation showed otherwise.
Forensic evidence said no.
Said no.
So right. Can we bring in Margarita now?
We can bring in Margarita.
Okay.
This leaves a huge hole in a potential embarrassment. You know, the grave that sanctifies the altar, Peter's not there.
Mm.
Right. So in comes this fascinating woman, Margarita Garducci.
Italian archaeologist.
Yes, epigraphist.
Yes, a force of nature. What's an epigraphist?
An epigraphist is someone who studies inscriptions.
So Garducci is famous as an epigraphist. She excavated on Crete.
Yes.
In 1950, wrote an important work on all of the Cretan inscriptions found at Hyortina.
Yes.
So she's the real deal.
She's the real deal.
A really legitimate archaeologist.
Right. So Thelma, I think we were both talking, we'd love to do an episode just on her.
Yes, because amazing accomplishments.
So she's brought in to do some of the things that Furua just brushed aside. And so she starts going down into the crypt, into the excavated necropolis, and starts studying these inscriptions.
On the graffiti wall.
On the graffiti wall in particular.
And she immediately notices, this is not gibberish, this is not nonsense, this is crucial to our knowledge of the necropolis.
It is. And so she starts finding things, symbols like the Kyro, the combination of the Greek letters, a shorthand for the name for Christ.
Mm-hmm.
She finds inscriptions saying things like, Peter, pray for us.
Yeah. Petros eni.
Petros eni was
Greek.
The big one, right?
Right. Which means Petros, Peter, eni from NSD. Peter is inside here.
Yeah. A piece of the wall fell off as a part of that graffito. And so this was all very intriguing.
And Furua is trying to suppress it. Right?
He is. Wanted nothing to do with this. Was incensed at this interpretation. But Garducci, one of the fascinating things that she does is that in studying the graffiti wall and seeing these inscriptions, you know, Peter pray for us, in particular, Peter is inside. Peter's here. She traces the record back and ends up discovering that box that Kaas had left behind in the storeroom, and it died without telling anybody.
So Kaas took out the box.
It took out the bones from the graffiti wall.
Separate box from the Furua box, which has the mouse and the women's bones in it.
Exactly right. So these are two different boxes. And so Garducci puts the pieces together and finds that these bones in Kaas's box came from the graffiti wall. And these bones were wrapped in a purple cloth. They seem to be, it's not a full skeleton, but it's the bones of a single man.
No other human remains or animal remains mix in with these bones.
Exactly right.
All from one specimen.
One specimen. The skull was missing, but the better part of the skeleton was there. The feet were missing.
The feet were violently removed.
Violently removed.
According to forensic evidence.
Exactly right. So when these bones were tested, I believe in 1968, they were shown to be the bones of a large man, likely in his 60s or 70s.
So this fits with the big fisherman idea.
Exactly right. And then the evidence of the feet being removed, the scarring from the sword or whatever they would have used, shows that the feet were violently removed, which squares with the tradition of Peter being crucified and crucified upside down.
Right.
What's the easiest way to get a body off a cross?
It's for a Roman soldier to sever the feet from the rest of the corpse.
That's right. Yeah. So Guarducci ends up being kind of the hero in this story to some degree. She solves the riddle. I mean, there's still more questions that we don't have time to go into here of you know, why the bones wound up in the graffiti wall. It's still very mysterious of if this is Peter, why was it moved from the principal grave into this wall that flanked the grave?
And pure skeptics would say, look, it's an interesting story. There's a lot of circumstantial evidence, but obviously the church has a highly vested interest in believing that this is what they say it is.
Exactly right. So there's always skeptics, especially when it's kind of an in-house Vatican project. But I should say that, you know, I'm a Protestant Christian, so if there are Catholics out there that would correct this, please do so. But my sense is that the church, when it comes to relics, the church, by and large, hasn't been all that quick to authenticate their archaeological truth.
Yeah, right? Things like the Titulus Crucis, or the sign over the cross.
Or the Shroud of Turin.
Right, they don't pontificate, for lack of a better word,
exactly right,
on the veracity, the authenticity of these objects.
Right. I think it was Pope John Paul II with the shroud said it's important as an aid to faith,
mm-hmm.
right? But not without going so far as saying that this is the burial shroud of Christ.
Right.
So the fact that the Vatican would come out and say, hey, this looks authentic, is striking.
Yeah, adds it perhaps more credibility.
More credibility, exactly right.
So let's talk, Jeff, as we wind down here, about your visit to the Scavi.
Yes. If you're ever in Rome, I highly recommend it. I've done this 5 different times. It's not something that you can just show up and do, though.
So you're a fixture, practically.
I am a fixture. They know me there.
Right.
The Swiss Guard, you know, they tip their cap. We'll put the link in the show notes. You make a reservation with the Vatican, usually a good 2-3 months ahead of time, and you get a time slot, and you can go behind the scenes. And I've done this 5 different times.
So you've seen the graffiti wall.
I have seen the graffiti wall. You can't get up close to it.
It's behind plexiglass or something?
You can kind of see it through kind of a crack in the excavation, because it is it's a very holy, holy place.
Mm-hmm.
But usually you'll go down there. A young priest will take you down. Last time I went, it was with a professor, American professor from John Cabot, who was phenomenal. And they start you on the far east end of the necropolis, and you get to see and walk into these glorious Roman tombs with lots of the frescoes and inscriptions still intact. It's very Indiana Jones. You go down these stairs, and the pressurized door opens up, and you walk back in time 2,000 years. It's incredible.
Hmm.
And then you wind up at the end, the west end. You can't walk to Peter's tomb, but you look kind of through the crack, and you can see the graffiti wall, and you can see the hole at the bottom. And the bones of Peter are kept in these lucite boxes. And what's really funny is every time I've done this tour, the priest or the guide with great pride will say that these boxes were designed by NASA.
Yeah.
And so they keep the bones. And you can see the yellowish white of the bones.
Well, if it is what it claims to be, it's very important.
Yes.
And NASA should be the person providing the storage boxes.
Absolutely.
Makes sense to me.
Exactly right.
And
yeah.
Supposedly if you drop a plumb line, right, from the altar that Bernini designed down, it goes directly to Peter's grave.
It does, right. And directly to the graffiti wall,
hmm.
which is very interesting, because you would think that if the grave was the site, it would be lined up above that, but it's lined up above the graffiti wall, which all suggests that the builders of the church recognized that the wall was the true grave. Right.
Well, that's really fascinating, Jeff. The times I've been to Rome many times, I haven't seen this yet. I'm going to put it on the list for next time.
Yeah, it's a must. Absolutely.
Yep. So this was a really interesting episode to me. We got to talk about Constantine. We got to talk about some of the early church fathers and their views on this. We looked at the New Testament. We got a little tour of Rome itself.
Yeah.
What did you like best about some of the things we talked about today?
I love stories in which kind of faith and historical fact intersect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not in ways that the historical fact has to kind of, I have to have that to have the faith.
Hmm.
But when those two things come together, that's kind of hair on the back of the neck for me. So, you know, to see the bones of Peter and to kind of trace back the story and to recognize that the provenance has some heft to it, I find that stuff endlessly fascinating.
You also really like true crime stories,
I love
you like
true crime.
To watch the, you know, the stories of the whodunits and the forensic evidence.
Exactly.
And the knuckle bone was found here at the bottom of the barrel and so forth.
Exactly. So what the story, at one level, it's a true crime story.
Well, before we give our gustatory parting shot, which I get to do this week,
yes,
we want to first thank all of our listeners for all the downloads and the great success they've given us, far beyond what we expected. We'd also like to ask them if they would leave some reviews for us.
Please do. Yes, that's a great way for the podcast to get before more ears. And we want to hear what you have to say, too. We would love to, if you want to give us ideas for topics for us to cover, don't hesitate.
Yeah, so we've gotten some good correspondence in the last few weeks. We'll talk about that a little more next week. Dave@adnauseum.com. Don't forget there's a V in there.
Yes.
And Jeff@adnauseum.com.
So what's on tap for next week?
Well, next week we're going to start a two-parter on the archaic Greek poet Hesiod.
Back to the Greeks.
That's right.
Yes.
For just 2 episodes. So Hesiod lived around 700 BC. He writes in the meter of Homer. And we're going to look at his works and days.
Yes, right at the very, very beginning of Greek literature.
That's right. Fascinating. That's
right. Stuff. That gets us to the end. So, Dave, give us our parting shot this week.
All right. So this is from David Auerbach. I like this one a lot. In wine, there is wisdom. In beer, there is strength. In water, there is bacteria.
I love it. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.